By far, the number one question that I get in Figma Academy isn't about components or prototyping. It's people saying, hey, wait a minute, how are you accessing your clipboard history like that? And the answer is always Raycast. Let's say that I'm in Pinterest making a mood board. I can copy 20 images in a row, jump into Figma, and then paste them all at once. No more switching apps, no more breaking flow. Once you build routines around unlimited searchable clipboard history, you simply cannot go back. And it's one of the many reasons that I use Raycast for pretty much everything I do on my computer. If you want to learn more, head to dive.club/Raycast. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now on to the episode.
We have become so obsessed with speed, among other things, and tools like the TLDR, that we have come to ignore how the brain works and what the brain wants. More than anything, what the brain wants is a story. It's not a list of bullet points. It's not a quick Slack message with an insight. It's a story. And if you do your job well here, you and your producer, then this interview, for example, how will it begin? It'll maybe begin with a hook. It's about giving your audience a reason to care. Why should I care about anything you're about to say in the next hour of this podcast? Is it worth it for me? And you don't get that when you TLDR stuff. You can tell an entire narrative, you know, a micro story in a minute, but it's about crafting it as the story.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. One of the biggest moments of imposter syndrome that I've ever had in my career was doing a user interview with Dr. Noam Segal. Not only did he have the number one user research course on all of Maven, but he also has led design research for companies like Airbnb, Meta, Twitter, Wealthfront, just to name a few. So I invited him on today to talk about specific strategies that you can use for conducting better interviews, synthesizing your research, making sense of the tooling landscape, and a lot more. So let's dive right in and hear from Noam about what makes effective research.
I think it's important to always remember that research is ultimately an exercise in risk reduction, or the flip side of that is confidence building. So you can look at it whichever way you want. But ultimately, as researchers or people practicing research, the first question for us to consider if we want to run effective research is, what are the risks here? And are there risks? Like, do we need to run this research? And we should be asking the people we work with, whoever they might be, product managers, etc., what do you see as the risk that we're trying to address with this research? And then the follow-up to that is obviously translating those risks, those questions, those things that are keeping certain people up at night into our learning goals. And ultimately, if we're able to understand our users, customers, clients, whatever you call them, to the extent that we answer and address our learning goals, then we've conducted effective research. So there has to be alignment between the risk we're trying to address and to make sure the risk is actually there, the learning goals that are derived from that definition of risk, and then the research itself that we carry out, which is meant to target those learning goals and complete our knowledge.
Can you talk a little bit about how you translate learning goals into an actionable research plan, and maybe like the different types of goals, and how does that inform the research techniques that you reach for?
When you're early on in the development process, the risks are quite different. Let's give a specific example of one of my favorite apps. You can probably see the plushie to the side, Duolingo. Duolingo, it's even in the name of the app. They started as a language learning platform. Right. Duolingo at some point decided to go into math and other topics, non-language topics. Now, that decision carries a lot of risk with it, right? Like, should we be venturing into this completely different space? And I think there's two specific types of risks, at least. One is the market, the audience. Like, is there a ripe market for this type of learning? And then the second question, which is really more related to what I do in the UX research space is what's going on in the ecosystem of, say, math learning apps, and where are those experiences broken and painful for people? Because ultimately, as researchers and as founders and entrepreneurs and people in tech, we're trying to identify pain, because if we can address that, then we succeed. And learning language has been a very painful process. So there's that sort of strategic research where the learning goals are just to understand what does the market look like, or where are current experiences broken and painful, and where are children between the ages of 9 and 12 failing in their math education. And that translates into very specific learning goals, higher level learning goals. But conversely, if you've already released, and Duolingo did release, you know, your first, second, or third iteration of the math learning experience, then the learning goals might be rather different. And they might be around how to improve the onboarding into the math experience, or how to make sure that the math learning doesn't cannibalize the language learning that your child has been doing, how to motivate children to learn math, and are those motivating factors and those little gamified things that Duolingo does, do the mechanisms align? Like, are there the same mechanisms for language learning and math learning? We don't know that. Maybe what motivates a child to learn a certain concept in math is different than what motivates a child to learn language. So our learning goals always have to align with sort of the level of exploration that we're trying to do, the pain points that we're trying to address, and the specific concerns that we have as a team in terms of our knowledge gaps. We need to be able as a team to identify our knowledge gaps. And the learning goals are directly tied to those.
I'm interested in that second half of the example where maybe either an MVP has shipped, or maybe designers are actively prototyping what an experience could look like. There's some kind of internal momentum from the product team itself. Could you talk a little bit about the different research tactics that you would be reaching for in that strategy? At a high level, I'm kind of curious, like, how you think about when to do more qualitative versus quantitative research, but I'm sure even within those buckets, there are different pathways that you would be considering.
There's something actually very interesting going on in the context of quant versus qual that I'd love to talk about. But let's begin with the basic thing that maybe a lot of people watching this already know. Quant gives you typically the what, and qual gives you the why, right? So if we stick with Duolingo, one of my favorite apps, as an example, a quant study can give you a what, like, most of our users aren't able to graduate. They don't tend to proceed beyond the third level of their math learning. There's a huge drop off there, and there's maybe major dissatisfaction or issues being reported. We don't know why it's happening, and we don't understand in depth what those issues are, but we know that they exist. So quant gives you that. It gives you the what's going on, but it leaves you with a lot of mystery around why. Why is this happening? Or another example might be that on a marketplace similar to the one I work at, you observe certain trends. For example, you observe a trend that the people hiring people for a job, so let's say it's a marketplace of clients who are hiring people for jobs and freelancers who are taking on jobs, and you notice that clients are giving freelancers bonuses in the middle of the job, not the end of it, right? Typically, people give bonuses when a job is finished. Typically, we tip people when the experience is over. So why would people give bonuses mid-job? There could be a bunch of reasons, but quant research will never get you those answers. So you can observe all sorts of interesting trends around drop-off, around friction, around frustrations, around pain points. But to understand them deeply, you need qualitative research, because that's what gives you the opportunity to actually listen to your users, either as they're using the product, or right after they use the product, or as they're using competitor products, and ask them these questions. You know, why are you doing what you're doing right now? What's the reason for it? And there've been some very exciting developments in terms of tooling and opportunities. I think a couple are worth noting. The first, which isn't a new development, is that it's become a lot easier to observe people either in their natural state of using a product or not as natural state of using the product. Would love to give a shout out to Descout, one of my favorite tools for diary studies. What are diary studies? It's our opportunity to observe people over time as they use a product, and they can record videos and record their screen and show us what they're doing in content, right? Another thing we can do is observe people as they are in a session. So we do have to make sure that we get people's consent for these sorts of things. But we can, in theory, as designers, as researchers, use tools like FullStory to track user sessions and replay those sessions and see how people progress through an experience. And that can give us a why. And the most interesting development I've noticed recently and I've been piloting and trying out is in the AI space. Because one of the most interesting things about qualitative versus quantitative research is that up until now, we've had to make a pretty crappy choice between understanding people at scale using quantitative methods, which only give us that what layer, that shallow, thin data, you might call it. Or we could run qualitative research with a very limited number of users. The typical number that is quoted again and again is 5, although there isn't much basis for that, I would suggest. So we could talk to a few people and gather thick data, rich data, the whys behind what they did. But that's a very narrow, you know, a very narrow sliver, very small scale. And there are now AI-based tools. The one we've been piloting is called Genway. And these tools are able to conduct qualitative interviews at essentially an infinite scale. So now you can gather both qualitative and quantitative data at any scale you wish. And that's a very exciting development. It doesn't change the fact that the fundamental difference is the what versus the why. But now you can gather as much what as you wish and as much whys as you wish.
If you can gather both the what and the why at scale, how do you think that that changes the day-to-day role of research?
So I'll say that for those who don't know me very well, I am kind of a techno-optimist, you might call it, and fairly bullish about these tools. I see the future of research in both the short term and the longer term as much more focused on planning for research and then activating insights once research has been conducted. Definitely researchers will continue to conduct certain types of research and maybe other types they won't. But definitely after that research has happened, the role of working within cross-functional teams and activating those insights and bringing them home and making sure that the user, the customer, remains in the center of what we do is still very much the core of the researcher role, in my opinion. And I think what these tools do is they don't replace us. What they do is they enable us to gather much richer, comprehensive data and insights than ever before. That's very good news, given the complexity of the experiences we're building. This whole idea of talking to 5 people, it came about in a very different era, I would suggest, when websites were very simple pages and apps didn't even exist and experiences were so much simpler. And these days, as we graduate into new modalities, new ways of interacting, new ways of human-computer interaction, and really complex experiences, both in the B2C and the B2B space, whether it's fintech, edtech, health tech, social, AR, VR, AI, whatever it might be, we need so much more feedback. And we need to be a lot more inclusive in how we design and who we design for. And the way to be more inclusive and the way to make your products work for the broadest audiences possible is to reach those audiences. And I think AI is what gets us there.
Yeah, so you mentioned Full Story and Genway, and I actually am pretty interested in your tooling recommendations as someone who's less familiar with the space. So maybe I'll toss a hypothetical your way. Let's say that tomorrow you take a role to build a research arm at a Series A, maybe a Series B startup. What is the tooling stack that you would be assembling?
It's a great question. The first tool I'll mention, and I haven't mentioned it yet, would be some sort of lightweight survey platform that can enable me to survey the people I serve, our users, our customers, both while they are in the context of using the product, this Series A, you know, fairly new product, or via email or whatever it might be. I'm a huge fan of Sprig and a huge supporter of Sprig. I think Sprig have built a very modern, forward-thinking platform that does a bunch of different things these days. They started with in-product survey, but they have since graduated to replays, which is what Full Story do. So you can use Sprig to replay user sessions. You can use them to conduct surveys, and you can also use them to do quantitative usability testing, essentially offer people the chance to interact with a concept and see how it works for them. So I think that powerful combination of in-context learning, in-context replays of user sessions, and in-context usability testing is a very powerful trio. And again, bullish on AI, a believer in AI. Sprig is an AI-enabled system with a bunch of tooling in the back end to help a researcher or designer synthesize, analyze, synthesize, understand the learnings. And one of the things they did very early on, which was powerful, is offer templates, you know, research-backed, standardized templates that you just know you can deploy and they will work for you because they were validated by an amazing team of researchers within Sprig who created all of these surveys. And writing a great survey is a huge challenge. So by using a tool like this, you get a lot out of it. I do think my second choice would be an AI tool like Genway, because I think that these sort of tools ultimately enable us to reach a scale that we've never been able to reach before. And again, I think given the responsibility that we have in the experiences that we're designing and the products we're working on, we want to be able to achieve that scale. We want to be as inclusive as possible. So I'm really glad I've had the chance to, you know, work with the team at Genway, give them feedback, pilot their tool. And I definitely love that sort of direction for research. And then the third tool is another one I already mentioned, a tool like DScout, which enables you to do everything from the typical diary study, but also just usability testing or whatever other types of testing you need to do. And I think together, these types of tools really give you, they get you to at least 80%, if not more, of both the quantitative and the qualitative abilities you need to have in order to thrive as an early stage startup.
I know we're talking about the scalability of research. I do want to zoom in though on strategies for conducting better interviewers, because for context for people listening, the way that we met is you were an instructor on Maven and I was interviewing you. And I remember being so nervous to interview the person that taught the interviewing course. So maybe we could even start at the beginning of your process. So let's say that you decide that you're going to conduct maybe 8 interviews over the course of a couple weeks. I'd like to better understand your preparation process. How much are you trying to standardize those conversations, and what are you doing to get the most out of that time with a user of your product?
So let's touch upon that standardization question first. I think one thing that's very important with interviews is that we don't want to have an interview script ever. We want to have an interview guide. And there's a very particular reason why we don't want to over-standardize our interviews. And that is that, and I wrote an article about this once, is that The magic moment in interviews, or moments, plural, is always in the follow-up question. That's where the magic lies. And those follow-up questions, by the way, are never in your interview guide, and they're certainly not in an interview script, which is overly standardized. Those are questions that come up organically because of the responses that you got and because you were listening to the person you're talking to. So first of all, we don't want to over-standardize our interview. Second of all, it always comes back to the goals that we have. And I like to give examples from other realms. So let's give an example from movie making. When you're the director of a movie, you have an idea, you probably have a storyboard of all of the scenes you need to capture and all of the takes you need to get in order for the movie to be complete. And of course, you're going to be editing this and changing things around, but there's a certain amount of raw material that you have to capture in order to be successful in reflecting the script visually, right? Similarly, as a researcher, I look at learning goals as my storyboard, so to speak, or my script, so to speak. It's the foundation that I'm building the questions on, right? And that's how I think of it. And the extent to which any question needs to exist and the depth of question necessary always goes back to that goal. If I'm trying to understand what sport someone plays, it's enough to ask them, what sport do you play? And if they say football, which by the way, when I say football, I mean what you Americans would call soccer, because you stole blasphemy. Football from us. It's absolute blasphemy. So if all I want to know is what sport you play, then I can ask you what sport you play. You say football, basketball, baseball, and we're good. I've achieved my learning goal. I've captured my shot. It's all good. But if my goal is also to understand what position you play within that game and how well you've been doing in that position over the past year, like what your statistics are, and what types of struggles have you had playing in that position, and how can I help you address those struggles through better coaching, then suddenly, based on my learning goals, there's a lot more questions to ask in order for me to fully capture the extent of the knowledge I'm trying to gain here, right? Now I have to ask you how you've been doing, and can you share certain statistics with me on how many goals you've scored or how many assists you've made if it's basketball? Now I have to listen to you share your pain points around techniques you've been struggling with. So that's the relationship between learning goals and questions. And there's always a moment in every researcher's research process where you have your interview guide, you have your learning goals, and you take one final look before you begin your research. And you look at all of the feedback you got on the research plan and all of the inputs you got, and you test one more time. Are my questions addressing these goals? If I get to all of these questions, will I have answered those goals? Very important to check before you begin the process.
Using your soccer example, there's a point where you want to figure out, okay, how can I help them as a coach? And yeah, you could double check your document to make sure that you have a question that is getting at that learning goal, but there's a really wide spectrum of how effective of a question that you're asking, because maybe you only have 30 minutes and you only get 7 or 8 questions. You have to make the most out of them. So can you talk a little bit about some of the common mistakes that you would see designers or researchers make when they're asking these questions?
Yeah. I mean, the issue you're bringing up actually relates to one of the problems with only conducting 5 or 8 interviews, right? Ideally, if I'm not able to reach the depth I need on all of my questions, I can shorten my interview guide and ask certain questions of one group and other questions of another group. And that way I'm not taking up more than 30 minutes of anyone's time, but I'm getting at all of the questions I need to. Usually what we observe as researchers is one of two things happening. Either we're getting to the depth we need to get and we're asking the right follow-up questions, but then we're not addressing all of our learning goals because we ran out of time. Or we skip too quickly. We kind of over time manage our interviews and we skip too quickly to the next question. And then we're really straddling that fine line between quantitative and qualitative research, because we're not doing the basic goal of qualitative research, which is to get at that deeper why. We're getting at some level of why, but not enough. So the trick, so to speak, is to create an interview guide and a research plan where you are able to touch upon all of your learning goals and all of your topics, but to do it at a sufficient depth. And if that's not happening in the first interview or two, which we often consider like, you know, pilot interviews, and we'll often test out our interviews, even just with each other, as, you know, as colleagues internally, then you have to adjust the plan, obviously. So I absolutely recommend piloting interviews, and I recommend being cognizant of those two very different types of mistakes, either not getting to all of the learning goals or not getting to the depth you want to get to within each learning goal. And there's an assumption I'm making here that you've taken great care, again, to come up with a crisp and clear and constrained set of learning goals that are each absolutely critical for the success of the project. You have to limit your learning goals. You can't just, you know, again, when I interview researchers and I ask them what's important, like about being a great researcher, like what makes a great researcher or what differentiates a good from an outstanding researcher. A lot of people talk about curiosity as one of those things. A lot of people present themselves as a very curious person. And it's true. I'm a curious person, and I do imagine most researchers are curious people. But research is not an exercise in curiosity. Research is not about just learning a bunch of stuff about a topic. Research is not about understanding everything about basketball because suddenly I have a new interest in a sport. It's about understanding very specific parts and pain points within an experience in order to make it better. So if you crisply define your learning goals, it makes it a lot easier to avoid mistakes down the line of not reaching all of them or of not reaching the depth you're trying to reach.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm gonna use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm gonna use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm gonna be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode.
It's interesting that you talked about the follow-up questions because it actually triggered a memory in maybe like the second or third interview that we had together where we had our 30-minute block and 99% of the value from that conversation came in the 5 minutes that we went over at the very, very end where you just got raw and just dumped on me. And even reflecting on that, I'm like, man, how could I have ensured that I got there and made sure that I am asking those right follow-up questions to get at more depth? And it makes me wonder if over the years you've developed certain strategies or maybe even specific phrases that you find yourself returning to ask better follow-up questions?
I think this is a good opportunity to give a shout out to one of the research interview gurus and an amazing person. And I consider him a mentor of mine and a friend, Steve Portigal. Steve Portigal wrote the book Interviewing Users. It's literally called Interviewing Users, and it's a marvelous book, and I consider it, you know, quote unquote, the Bible of interviewing people. And I think one thing you notice when you read his book, and a new edition just came out recently, and I think it's somewhere on my shelf right there, I think. When you look at the book, I think one thing you realize is that so much of the success of your interviews depends on your approach to interviewing in the first place. And I think that's what helps you avoid that situation where it's only in the extra 5 minutes that you get to what you actually want to get to. And let me give some specific explanations and guidance to people. The first I would just put as humility. As designers especially, you have so much training in crafting experiences and best practices for how to put together amazing products and amazing designs. And you have design systems and you have all sorts of guides around accessibility and typography. And I mean, we could go on and on. And you have amazing tooling these days with Figma. The world is good. But the problem is, there is one thing that you are not the expert in. And that is the experience of the users you're trying to serve. You're an expert in everything else, but you're not an expert in that. And so the way Steve puts this is, you have to check your worldview at the door and you have to check your experiences at the door to really listen. So that's number one. Number two, and I sort of alluded to this in some of the things we've already talked about, is it's really important to nail the context of the interview. I mean, when are you interviewing a person? And is it the right time to be asking the questions that you have? Where are you interviewing them? What are you asking them to do in the interview? All of these questions that the context interview is happening in can really affect your ability to get at the right responses. And without that, there isn't a follow-up question in the world that would be able to help you. Some more coming here. I'm not quite done yet. The third thing is around rapport. Rapport is so important. You and I know each other, Rid. So we have basic rapport. And I feel very comfortable talking to you. But it's important to acknowledge that an interview situation is not a natural situation for people. We don't go about our lives being interviewed by people. We're not freaking celebrities. So building initial rapport puts people in a comfortable state to answer questions and to give you the information you need, and maybe even prevent you from the need to ask brilliant follow-up questions, because things just come out. Things will not come out naturally if the rapport isn't there. Next up, you can't ask a great follow-up question if you ain't listening. And there's this annoying human tendency. I don't know if you're doing it now. Maybe you are. Let's see what you say. Like, be candid with me. But there's this annoying human tendency to listen, quote unquote, to someone. But really what you're doing is simply thinking about the next question you want to ask. You're thinking about the next question you want to ask. You're not really listening to what I'm saying. Your ability to ask a great follow-up question is highly dependent on you listening to the person, not thinking about your predetermined follow-up question. Because that's not going to be the best follow-up question. That's for sure. Are you doing it right now, Reid?
It's so funny because we're having like this meta conversation where I've actually felt myself now two or three times having to combat that, where part of my brain starts going to my outline and where I want to take this conversation. But I'm like, no, I don't want to miss something. So it is like this struggle and I feel it for sure.
Yeah, I hear you. And then just two more quick things. One is around, again, considering your goals, considering your learning goals. Follow-up questions are ultimately tied to those goals. So researchers, you know, the best researchers always have their learning goals in front of them and in mind. And they're thinking to themselves, have I reached the correct resolution, the correct depth in order for me to move on, or is there follow-up needed? And then the final thing is just, there are specific types of follow-up question, right? For example, one very basic one is just to ask why. Again, you might have heard of the five whys framework. I'm not a huge fan because I think it's just, again, putting a random number onto something. But definitely asking why again can be a great follow-up question. Asking people to clarify what they said. Asking people to address certain emotional responses you notice when they say something. All sorts of different probing techniques exist. And again, I recommend Steve's book to kind of see the full list of potential follow-ups.
You mentioned the rapport piece. I want to talk about that for a second, because it's like such a valuable skill that is almost never talked about. And it reminds me of something that I read or listened to, but it talked about how to do well in that first like 20 seconds on a Zoom call and the effectiveness of basically oversharing and not just saying like, how are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing good. You know, but like, oh, you know, actually I was up a little bit late last night watching X basketball game and I have a 2-month-old kid. So I was dealing with that this morning and creating these like conversational strands that people can pull on and relate to. I'm wondering, are there other things that you're doing in these conversations to make people feel comfortable and to more effectively build rapport with the person that you're interviewing?
Well, first of all, I love your comment. And to me, it ties to my typical rapport question, which I'll share in a second, which is around specificity. I think your comment was around specificity, like getting specific, unpacking things, not just going through the motions and pretending to be polite and asking someone how they are, and then they say good, and then you kind of move on. The question I've always used, and especially since COVID hit and a lot of people moved to working in their home in an office space or some other room or outside or wherever they might be, I love to ask people about their background. Like literally something that I notice in their background. And I ask about it because usually when people have something, certainly if they're in their home, it's because it means something to them. It's because they care about it. So first of all, I want to give people a chance to talk about something they care about that has nothing to do with the interview. And I'm just showcasing an interest in something that goes beyond the interview goals. Second of all, I then try and find some way in which the thing they care about is also interesting to me and valuable to me. And I think ultimately, what does building rapport mean? It's about building connection. And when do we feel connection? We feel connection, among other things, when people feel like other people care about the things that they care about and other people resonate with things that they are saying. And that there's some sort of bond over something. So, you know, my background has some whiskey or bourbon. You know, maybe you're a bourbon drinker. We could talk about that. My background has Freud because I'm a psychologist by training. So maybe we could talk about, you know, psychology. My background has the Duolingo. Plus, we've talked about Duolingo enough in this conversation. But I'm a language lover and a lifetime language learner. And there's all sorts of other things, a bunch of coaching related books because I do coaching. There's a bunch of things going on. And any one of those you could ask me about and leverage that as a question to show interest in me as a person and build connection. So that's my trick and that's why I think it works. And again, it ties really nicely to what you were talking about in terms of specificity, like get specific, talk about something concrete and in depth and take the time, take 3, 4, even 5 minutes out of the interview rather than just 30 seconds because the other 25 minutes of the interview will be so much more effective thanks to it. You're not losing time here. You're gaining insight. And that's a very important distinction to make.
I love that. I got such a big smile on my face. Also, it's so practical. Like that's such a nice tool that people can just literally use on Monday, the next time they're hopping into any kind of Zoom conversation, not even an interview context. I want to move our hypothetical example along a little bit. So let's say you've had these 8 research calls. I've worked on teams in the past where basically it would just be taking the notes from those calls and dumping them into a customer interviews Slack channel, and mostly nobody really even pays attention. So I want to talk about storytelling a little bit because you talk about this idea of helping people become masterful research storytellers. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like?
I mean, I have a lot of takes on this. One take, for example, is that we have become so obsessed with speed, among other things, and tools like the TLDR, that we have come to ignore how the brain works and what the brain wants. There are really some specific things that the brain wants, but more than anything, what the brain wants is a story. It's not a list of bullet points. It's not a quick Slack message with an insight. It's a story. And, you know, if you do your job well here, you and your producer, then this interview, for example, how will it begin? It'll maybe begin with a hook, right? The hook is really important. What's the hook about? It's about giving your audience a reason to care. Why should I care about anything you're about to say in the next hour of this podcast? Is it worth it for me? And you don't get that when you TLDR stuff and when you send out quick Slack messages. You don't get that hook. Now, that hook can be very brief. You can tell an entire narrative, you know, a micro story in a minute. You can tell an entire story in a Slack message, but it's about crafting it as a story. And people who know me know that I'm a huge fan of creators like Mr. Beast on YouTube, because Mr. Beast really nailed the basic principles of storytelling. His hooks, for example, are some of the best in the industry. And when you look at the first 30 seconds of any of his YouTubes, you immediately understand what's going on. Like, what am I about to see here? Why should I care about this thing? And like, what can we do about this? Like, what will this mean for us? How will this change us as an audience? So, you know, adapting your stories to what the brain needs is incredibly, incredibly important. I'll give you another factor as an example, emotion. You know, messages work better when they speak both to the more foundational parts of the brain and the higher order, newer, maybe more sophisticated parts of the brain. The rational and logical parts, so to speak, because we're not really, but, you know, and the more emotional kind of basic parts. Emotion matters a lot, and there's a reason why when we show leadership within the company we work at, or fellow designers, fellow researchers, whoever it might be, when we show them a video of a person we serve, a user, a participant, really struggling to do something, and you can see that frustration in their eyes, in their face, in their body, it does something to us that no Slack message could ever do. We feel that emotion, it's mirrored in our own brain, and we suddenly have an attachment to this and a stronger motivation to do something about it. So emotion matters a lot in storytelling. So these are a couple of examples, but I think the overarching point I think I'm trying to make here is that our brains evolved to crave stories, actual stories, not TLDRs, not a bunch of random bullet points, not a collection of messages. And so I understand the need for, you know, moving fast and doing things at a strong pace that works for the entire team. And what I'm saying is that we can all craft micro stories, short stories that meet the definition of what makes a great story, but also meet the need for speed at the same time. And where we've gone wrong is that we've sacrificed one for the other. We've sacrificed story for speed.
Let's make it a little bit more clear what a good micro story could look like. Like, let's say you've come out of some kind of a research process or in this product area and you are reporting back to the team. How would you approach crafting that micro story?
Let me give you a very specific example that I teach about. And I call this the pain insight equilibrium. Okay. So let's say I'm a researcher at Duolingo, just did some research on this math product that's about to come out, and I have insights, you know, like we need to include this feature in math learning or whatever it might be. Okay. One option would be to just TLDR it, just share that insight. Hello, executives. We need to put this feature for math learning in the product. That's the short version. You want the bottom line? That's the bottom line. This technique I talk about, this framework of the pain insight equilibrium, what is this about? It's about the fact that your insights become a lot more compelling when the pain that led to them is also just as clear. And you really have to balance the two. Anyone from Duolingo CEO, their executive team, down to every single IC on every single product team working on this math product will feel a lot more compelled to act on it and will internalize the insight a lot better when the pain point that led to it is just as clear. How did we get to this insight? How did we get here? The brain craves that and will never be satisfied or at peace. It will never reach that equilibrium until you answer both of those sides.
Before I let you go, I want to zoom out and get your take on something, because I was listening to Lenny's podcast where Judd Anton, past colleague, talked about how the purpose of research is to falsify ideas, not to validate ideas. And I felt a little bit convicted listening, because I've definitely worked in environments where it felt like we were doing more research theater and checking a box on the way to get a feature out the door. So my question is, what do you think are the keys for research to be more integrated earlier in the product process, rather than just a hoop that teams have to jump through in order to feel good about shipping something?
Anyone who trained as a researcher in academia knows that there's this basic scientific principle that indeed research never validates anything. It's this idea that just because the sun rose in the east today doesn't mean the same thing will happen tomorrow. Science is about falsifying ideas, not about validating them. Science is about finding support for certain ideas. But there's never anything in this world that science will validate and stamp as 100% true always. That's not how science works. And that's, I think, you know, based on what I know of Judd's background and academic background and my own, that's where we're coming from when we say this. I also think part of it is coming from this frustration that we have when research, to your point, is leveraged in a very narrow way. And I think there's a few things to say here. The first is that research, just like design, should be and really has to be incorporated along the entire product development process. And in particular, we need to be, as researchers or designers doing research, we need to be activating our insights, bringing in our insights to every single design crit or other meeting that happens early on when, you know, we might not even have an initial prototype. Research has to come in at each and every one of those stages of the product development process in order for it to be fully leveraged and to be impactful. Or in other words, one of the issues is that all too often research is brought in too late, and maybe design is sometimes brought in too late, and maybe other functions feel this as well, and that's an issue. Second of all, I think there's this wrong idea around the tension between user empathy and finding ways to drive profit and grow the business. You know, that's bullshit. That tension is bullshit for a couple of reasons. Maybe one of them I don't need to go into. Like, we could have a whole discussion about user empathy and what that means, and do we need to have empathy per se or something else in order to be effective in building amazing products that serve people. But the issue I want to focus on isn't that. The issue is that our entire fields, in my opinion, are based on the premise that we could build anything. We could build whatever the fuck we wanted to build, but we shouldn't, right? Because people don't want us to build just anything. And people have certain mental models, and people have certain ways of experiencing the world and viewing the world, and people have certain needs. And when we meet those needs, instead of just building anything, we succeed, right? I think that's a premise of what we do. So I'm always surprised to hear about this supposed tension between serving our users or serving the business. Because I believe that when we serve our users, customers, clients, we also serve the business. It's as simple as that, you know? I will use my Peloton more often if Peloton builds a product that motivates me and excites me and brings me joy and fun, and the exercises are great and the instructors are great. 100%. I'll listen to more Spotify if I have access to all of the music I love and playlists that are personalized to my needs and awesome suggestions and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. When these tools meet my needs better, I will use them more. That generates more revenue and success to businesses. So there isn't a real tension there. And we are not in some fight over, like, should we just be like, I just want you to validate my ideas because my ideas are different from what you do. You look at user needs. I look at business needs. So we're clashing. There is no clash. There is no clash. And sure, I want to do more than just validating someone's ideas, absolutely. But I think they want that too, honestly. I think we all want the same thing ultimately. And I think we, and by we I mean designers, researchers, obviously, we should feel like we have the agency here to deliver awesome research at any stage of the product development process and to give people what they need and what I think they know they need. And then I know we're basically out of time.
I love that perspective. We've covered a ton of ground. I want to be respectful of time. Is there anything else that you want to talk about or any other questions that I should be asking before I let you go?
I'll say one more thing, which is one of the questions you had was around micro versus macro research, and micro research being usability testing or research. And I loved that you used the word micro rather than tactical, because another thing that came up in that conversation between Judd and Lenny is that usability testing is anything but tactical, certainly in the impact it can have on the business. When you usability test, you could call that, I'm just validating, I'm just doing a last check before I ship something. But when you run those sort of tests, you can often find issues, usability issues, or even issues in the copy, even issues in the call to action you have, which once resolved can have an outsized, incredible impact on both the users and the company. You know, millions of dollars worth of additional revenue, much less effort for people, much less friction, much more delightful design. So just because research happens towards the end, or just because it's usability research or micro research, that doesn't mean it's just validating what we're doing. That's really a matter of perspective. That's a matter of attitude. I might say it's us looking into whether everything we crafted based on previous insights, hopefully, really delivers the promise it should have. And maybe it doesn't. And that's a great thing to find out. So I'm also anti-validation, but I think there's all sorts of processes happening here, which we should be cognizant of and avoid making certain mistakes in how we frame things. And just have a more positive attitude around, you know, conducting both micro and macro research, knowing that we have agency to make huge impact and to try and deliver our research at every single stage of the product development process and to really insert ourselves in there. Because there will come a day when, you know, AI does enable us to focus on some things and not focus on other things. And I think that activation and being part of those meetings will, for the long run, continue to be our role as researchers and as designers. I'm very optimistic about both research as a field, user experience and design as a field. I'm optimistic about the impact that AI will have on our field. I think there's a lot we need to be thinking about in terms of how our field is shifting. I do want to note that even for me personally and many, many other people, these have been very challenging times, difficult times. You know, I went through a layoff. A lot of people have been through layoffs. So on the one hand, I'm optimistic. And on the other hand, I just want to acknowledge that there's been a lot of struggle in our field and a lack of clarity around what's going to happen. So if anyone out there is concerned, first of all, I'm always happy to, you know, chat via LinkedIn or whatever it might be. And I'm sure we'll add whatever links to the show notes. So please feel free to get in touch. I'm also always happy to debate various research principles, foundations, techniques, so please feel free. And I just hope we continue to develop as researchers and as people who practice research, because in case this didn't come through in this conversation, research is such a rich and multi-layered and complex practice. And I think sometimes that goes underappreciated. We could talk about so many more things that we don't have the time to do. So I hope that everyone watching this continues to dive even deeper into research and research practice. You'll find it incredibly beneficial, and we'll all be building and designing better things thanks to it.
That was beautiful. Thank you, Noam. I really appreciate you taking the time today. It's such a joy to reconnect, and just you're a wealth of knowledge on so many things. So thank you for taking the time to share it with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.